Good afternoon. You're listening to Talk on the Rock, your local live call-in show. The time is 1:04, and we have our guest, Vivian Faith Prescott, in the studio today with us. She is a published and award-winning poet. So you can call in anytime during this program to just say hi or ask a question. That number is 874-2345. So, Vivian, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And so you've got your book open and ready. Go ahead and read us a poem.
Well, since it's a snowy day, I thought I'd read to you a poem from The Height of My Tongue, which is my poem about my experience in the Tlingit language revitalization. And I'm a little bit rusty with the Tlingit language, so you have to forgive me if I don't say this poem correctly, but here's my poem. Ayakaya dan ka du tsutan she yiwe tsisk wushi du judgi shi yi. It's snowing heavy, and the songbird sings her morning song, her snowshoe song.
Absolutely. Okay. And then let's just go ahead and jump off of that. So the Tlingit language has, you know, you have a huge interest in it, and it has a huge role in your work, and especially this book that you have right here, The Height of My Tongue. Go ahead and tell me how you became interested in learning Tlingit.
Well, I'd moved to the village of Huna, my children's ancestral homeland in the area of Glacier Bay and Huna. And I needed a language to graduate with my bachelor's degree, and all they had was Spanish on for distance. And I didn't want to put a Spanish language in a Alaska Studies degree. So I petitioned the university and their department to take the high school Tlingit language course at a college level, and the teachers helped me bump it up to that level. And so I started learning with high schoolers, and it was really great because they just kind of threw me in. The first day I had to go in and teach kindergartners how to speak Tlingit. And so I had my house, one of the things you do is you label your whole house in the language that you're learning. So I had everything labeled with 3x5 cards. And my daughter came, Vivian Mork, came to visit me. And in the bathroom by the toilet paper holder is Gunde Aktuati. I need to use the bathroom, or where's your bathroom? And so that was the first sentence that she learned. But she also learned, you know, refrigerator and stove and all these phrases. And so she went back to the university and just jumped in with both feet and started learning. And now she's, semi-fluent, but she's teaches Tlingit language and stuff like that. So she's really good.
Yeah, where does she teach? I'm curious.
Well, she's taken a break for the last few years, focusing on other things, but she's just moved to Juneau this week. So she's going to be, I don't know if she's going to be working with the preschool they started there or even at the university. I think she's going to just start getting involved with the revitalization and as probably a volunteer and things like that.
Yeah, and so you were the one who inspired her. Yeah, what did that mean to you when, you know, for you to learn the language, but then to see her learn it, and like you said, almost fluently?
Well, it's pretty special. We went to a 10-day immersion camp in Glacier Bay with 30 other people years ago, and we were only supposed to speak Tlingit for 10 days, and there was myself and Vivian and Nika, who lives here in town. So we were only speaking to each other in Tlingit, and being very beginning speakers, it was very scary to be able to. And we realized after the end of that 10 days, we went to Juneau and went shopping in Fred Meyer in Tlingit, and we were walking down the aisles, and we realized that it was the first time in many generations that the family, you know, them anyway, had been able to speak and communicate in the language, even though it was baby talk, we call it.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, like you said, that is yeah, to have the language stripped from, you know, these people. Yeah, I see what you're saying. To have the different generations being able to speak it to each other, that's pretty cool. Yeah, and so this is your, you know, Tlingit is your, like, your adopted clan. This is not your...
Yeah, I'm not Tlingit.
Yeah.
But I'm adopted in the Tuktaintan clan from Glacier Bay.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. One more question on Tlingit. You mentioned that you had everything in your house labeled, even things like refrigerator. I'm wondering, like, there's a Tlingit word for refrigerator? Like, this is a old school language.
Yeah, there's new words that people have had to come up with, like computer, which I don't remember what that it was, but there's a lot of things that you have to figure out. Well, what is the closest word? And there are people that invent the words.
Okay. Cool. Well, yeah, and that means that, you know, a language has to grow and reinvent itself to survive, so... That's a good thing. That's pretty cool. So the time is 1:10. We're going to take a quick break. And now is a good time to call in if you have any questions for Vivian or you just want to say hi. Yeah. So we will be back shortly. All right, we are back. The time is 1:12, and we have Vivian Faith Prescott in the studio with us today to read some poems and talk about her career and work as a poet. So, Vivian, you're born and raised in Wrangell, and you're living in Wrangell with us today. So tell me, how did it even become possible for you living in small town Alaska to realize that pursuing poetry on a very serious level was something you could even do?
I think it's all the money involved in poetry, I think, because I'm really rich because I write lots of poems. No, I'm just kidding. You don't make a lot of money in poetry. And I didn't want to go the university route by teaching. I just wanted to be able to write. So I think I started out, you know, very young, just for the fact that when I was 11, I wrote my first poem, and then I started writing short stories, and I became known in middle school. You can probably ask some Wrangellites that, and for writing poetry. And so I knew it was something I always wanted to do, but I obviously knew, well, what can you do with a writing career? And I really didn't know, but I eventually moved away and was going to pursue actually the nursing field. And I went into that field and actually became a nurse. But at that time, I had a friend who died suddenly of a heart attack. And I was walking on the trail in Juneau by the airport with my sister. And I had been taking some poetry classes along with the nursing classes. And I just said, you know, I don't know what to do. I really want to pursue writing. And my sister said, she's a school counselor, so she knew how to put the question. She said, well, what would you regret? Picture yourself on your deathbed. And what would you regret? Not being a nurse or not seeing how far your writing will take you. And I started crying at that moment. I knew that it was my writing. So I had to go the other direction. So I kind of gave up the field of nursing, and even though I didn't get very far in it, but I was their top student, so they were kind of disappointed when I said, well, I don't think I'm going to do this anymore.
Oh, wow.
And so I started pursuing my writing.
All right. Continue. Where did that lead you?
Well, I started to send out my work more, and that's always been more difficult for me because I probably have kind of a thin skin. I don't like, you know, people saying, that poem sucks, but I guess when it does, it does. So I started sending out my work, and my husband Howie Martindale. He started saving my rejection letters, because if you read Stephen King's book on writing when he was in high school, and he was sending out all these stories to all these magazines, and so he kind of recommended you put a nail on your wall and you hang all your rejection slips, and how wonderful that was. And so my husband started hanging my rejection letters, and I just really balked at that. I didn't want it. No, I'm putting them in a drawer. So they're in a file. But so basically, the more you send your work out, and the more you work on it, the more likely you'll get published.
Yep, absolutely. And yeah, since then you've received awards, you've been nominated for a Pushcart, and you've been published with Red Hen, Finishing Line Press. These are pretty big names in the poetry world, I would say. Yeah, let's go ahead and hit me with another poem.
I have this collection of two chapbooks, and I'm working on a third one, but it'll eventually be a full-length book about living in Wrangell through the 1970s and during the pipeline and things like that. And a lot of it, the poems are about poverty and our relationship with oil. And I also raised my kids around the bay, we call it, on Shoestack Point, next to the tank farms there. It's pretty much in our backyard. So a lot of the poems were about raising my kids in a... And the tanks had problems where they would spill on our land. And I used to call it my Jed Clampett property, because you could, you know, dig a hole and find oil. So I have Slick... They're really catchy titles. Slick is one of them. That's online. You can read it at White Knuckle Press. And then I have this one that's called Sludge, and that's a catchy title too. But these poems are designed to be 100 words or less, so it's really hard to get them into the form, and they're prose poems. And this one is called Pipe Dreams, and I'll give you a little bit of background information. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 paved the way for the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Wrangell, Petersburg, Tenneke, and Ketchikan Native communities were left out of the settlement. Also, carbon furnace, that's a word I'm going to use in this poem, is a play on the word carboniferous, which is a geological period around 300 million years ago. Carboniferous means coal-bearing. So this poem here is called Pipe Dreams, and there's a quote from Andrew Isaac, traditional Tanacross chief, that says, "We made our claim in 1963 because the state came in and selected our land, everything, even our vinyl graveyard." And here's the poem. "In our carbon furnace era, we wait for our new pickup truck, the diatoms to die in the basin of earth. New Sears windows for our house, for the fine-grained shale to heat. We wait for the beach lot we've had our eye on, our share of 44 million acres. We wait for the 92nd Congress, a declaration of settlement, until shockwaves pass through us and we're left out of the deal. And like ravens stealing water, we fly up from our own myth, up through the smoke hole, until the smoke spirits catch and hold us, until the fire turns us all pitch black."
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for reading that. So, one of the things that is really interesting about your work, I knew coming into it that there was going to be a lot of emphasis on Native culture, but I love that there's a lot of Native myths referenced and a lot of Native history, like Native modern history, like you just said, the Settlement Act. Why do you mention the Native Settlement Act? Why do you mention these things that the government has done in our modern history? And you even, you know, pull quotes from people that were working for these Native agencies in the government. Why is that relevant to you? Why do you pull from that?
Well, foremost, I'm a storyteller, And so poetry, in a way, to tell stories. And I think when we think of myth and stories, you often think of things that are in the past, maybe even 100 years, maybe even 1,000 years, 2,000 years. But I think what we're living in now and what we've gone through in our own lifetimes are just as fascinating and just as interesting. And I think every book that I write and poems that I write are something that I'm going to leave my children. They're really the focus of everything. And since they've got a multicultural heritage, I tap into those things. I'm part Sami and German and Irish and Norwegian and Finnish. And I love all the myths from those cultures and stuff. And so I try to relate to that, because myth and telling stories is a really good way to touch upon the subjects that you can't quite process yet.
Yes, exactly. That makes sense. The mysteries. Okay. And you mentioned Sami. You are, you know, you have heritage in this this Sami heritage. Explain what that is and what is your interest in it.
Well, the Sami are the indigenous peoples of Scandinavia, and there's like four countries, Russia, Finland, Sweden, Norway. And, you know, originally there was no borders. The people just were moving around from area to area. But my family came over here to Wrangell, but they migrated to, I think, Michigan area first, and then Astoria, and then to Wrangell. So we were always called the Lapp family, L-A-P-P. So, and I didn't know what that meant. So I've had family researching our heritage and things like that. And so I've just been reaching out to the Sami communities. There's quite a large North American Sami community in Washington, Minnesota, Michigan, some in Florida.
And what are some of their, you know, you mentioned them in your work. Yeah, how does that influence your work exactly?
I think because now I'm trying to learn the language, and I'm just beginning. So I started learning about what dialect I might learn. The North Sami dialect is probably the most spoken dialect. So I actually started looking at words for snow. And started, okay, how do I pronounce this? And then the meanings, and of course in the Arctic they have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of words for snow. And I started actually writing poetry based upon that. So I have words for snow, and then I have a poem. And it's usually about the Sami who are separated from culture. But also I imagined, well, what did my relatives do when they were over in Norway and Finland?
What do you mean they were separated from culture?
Well, the people that come over here,
yeah, as
the diaspora, you know, separated uh-huh. from, and how do you reconnect?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay. Yeah, go ahead and hit me with your Sami poem.
This is a snow poem. Today is snowy. But what I did was take a word from a dictionary that spoke to me and usually wrote a poem to that. But I also sometimes had poems where I was reading about Sami culture, and I would write a poem, and then later on I would look up to see which word I felt went really good with this particular poem. But this one's called Ovlas. And it's called Depression or Hollow with Slushy Snow on It. So that would be the dictionary term. And here's the poem. Do not speak too forceful with sharp, unguarded words, especially on the tundra. Do not call out a greeting. Do not look back and do not wave. Never say goodbye. Goodbye is forever. Don't abruptly tell the news from afar, but little by little, tell us where the ice has formed a muted space, and the new ice is so weak it cannot bear us. And that basically deals with Sami and Arctic taboos, and they're similar to even in in Yupik too, is that you never say goodbye.
Okay. Yeah, you never say goodbye. Why?
I think it's because it's permanent, and it's kind of like maybe you'll jinx it because you do want to see the person again. Most people, you want to see them again.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you for reading that one too. And so, let's see. You know what? I know you have another one that is a little longer. I would love for you to just go ahead and jump into that one too. And give us an intro for what this is about. And the title is Grandmothers Are Cliché. Why are they cliché?
This is actually probably one of my favorite poems. And I think people do request me to read this poem at readings. When I was in my Master's of Fine Arts program through the University of Alaska, it's a low residency one if anybody's interested in doing it. It's great. One of my mentors, I had written a poem that's actually in one of these other books about the grandmother that I had imagined living over in Finland and Norway area, what she would have been like before migration. And my mentor had just kind of said, grandmothers are cliche. And he didn't want me to write about this grandmother or this exploration of ancestry. And so, of course, I did the opposite of what he said, because no one's going to tell me what I can and can't write. So this is called Grandmothers Are Cliche. Grandmothers crochet and take in 4 grandchildren and give their daughters breathalyzers before they can see their kids. Grandmothers write copy for Amazon. Grandmothers have PhDs and MFAs and take care of their PTSD soldier husbands who return from Iraq, kicking and screaming at them, pulling the covers to hide in the dark. Grandmothers' houses are robbed by their meth head grandsons. Grandmothers sift through the garbage dump on the beach for tossed away metal and glass to make art. Grandmothers weave dance robes. Grandmothers are CEOs signing $1 million language revitalization checks. Grandmothers carve dance masks from alder. Grandmothers harvest fireweed and mountain goat hair and pull cedar bark from trees. Grandmothers blow deer calls made of leaves. Grandmothers play with Ouija boards. Grandmothers fish for salmon. Grandmothers hunt moose. Grandmothers teach second grade. Grandmothers gut deer. Grandmothers lie on the muskeg on their bellies, picking cranberries. Grandmothers fall in love with young men who work around their houses for the summer. Grandmothers chop wood. Grandmothers practice tsunami evacuations. Grandmothers fall in love with women who sculpt owls. Grandmothers. Grandmothers wipe blueberry-stained fingers and blood from their hands, periods flowing and ending, salmon hearts pulsing in their palms. Grandmothers clutch their empty bellies. Grandmothers fill them up. Grandmothers trace scars across their chests and comets across the sky. Grandmothers hold grandfathers or grandmothers in the blue dark night. The blue dark night holds grandmothers. Grandmothers carry grandchildren to medevac planes. Grandmothers feed great-grandfathers, feed grandkids and great-grandkids. Grandmothers join wet T-shirt contests, wash the faces of their brain-dead sons, and slice open halibut. Grandmothers change flat tires on Honda Fits. Grandmothers love the scent of outboard exhaust. Grandmothers offer salmon casseroles at the threshold of the newly deceased. Grandmothers remember names and then forget names. Grandmothers read Mad Magazine. Grandmothers stand in the dark with one another, listening for the humpback song. Grandmothers love their beer. Grandmothers collect Japanese dolls. Grandmothers march through town carrying signs to save rivers, stop dams, and mining. Grandmothers wear hoodies. Grandmothers wear brown rubber boots. Grandmothers smoke cigarettes next to grandkids while eating Mystic Mint cookies and watching Fox News. Grandmothers pick the tails off of thousands and thousands of shrimp. Grandmothers sigh when herons fly close to their heads. On the beach, grandmothers trip on slick, wet rocks and fold themselves into holy rites, slicing their cheeks on igneous. Grandmothers lie there waiting in the tidal interval for the duration of rise and the duration of fall.
Thank you. And tell me, what was your intention with this poem?
To show just how not cliche grandmothers are. Because I knew so many grandmothers. Wait a minute. First I said, wait a minute. I'm a grandmother. I'm not cliche. How am I not cliche? So a few of those are me in there. Mm-hmm. And some are people that I know. And then I looked around my community and said, there's some really cool grandmothers. And I think one of them was at the time, Rosita Worrell was the CEO of Sea Alaska, and she had just signed this, you know, $1 million language revitalization check. And I thought, she's a really cool grandmother. And some of them are the Weaver relatives that I knew and things like that. So,
yeah.
And my grandmothers are definitely in there. There's the Mystic Mints and the and the smoking cigarettes is actually my stepmother.
News.
And then I had grandmothers in there. My grandmother loved beer.
Okay. That's awesome. Yeah. There's a lot of people in there. Okay. Well, I love that. So, Vivian, I think our time is about up. So thank you for coming in and reading your poems. Maybe you can do a quick plug. Let us know how we can get your work.
The 56 North Downtown sells my most of my books, and I'm trying to get them in the museum in the Nolan's gift shop too, but you can also order through the publishers, and Amazon has, I think, The Height of My Tongue and a couple of them, but Finishing Line Press has Traveling with the Underground People. And Our Tents Are Small Volcanoes is the chapbook. It's down at 56 North. And my cousin Frank Churchill, I want to plug Frank's photography, did the cover of Northern Lights for this little chapbook. And you can order from the publisher or get it from 56 North.
Awesome. Okay. Vivian, thank you for your time, and I hope to see you again.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. So the time is 1:33, and we will be back next week with another guest. Peace out.